Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
And I'm tired. And I don't get tired of movies, but good Lord, Hannah, I'm tired.
It's easy to get tired of movies this time of year. It's a little overwhelming.
I'm easily getting one a day now, and I should, if I was doing this correctly, should be getting two a day.
I'm seeing probably, on average, 6 movies a week right now.
I'm so proud of you.
Yeah.
That's so un-Hannah.
At least half of which I would never in a million years see, except for you. So, and in fact, once again, I did subject myself this week to a few films that are as far from mainstream as you could possibly get.
Yeah, you
and
did.
You missed a couple of the biggies in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, and also the sports biopic Bleed for This, which I'll have to talk about solo.
I did miss the two, I guess they're the two biggest this week, but that means for you, for a favor, I will do the heavy lifting on everything else, the coming-of-age drama, The Edge of 17, a couple of psychological thriller revenge movies, Nocturnal Animals, which I remember you just loved, our standard French film of the week called Elle, and finally we'll talk about The Love Witch, and that it's a movie, but it's an homage. So I think you might need a little liquid help for this.
I think I will need some wine for this one. What have we got?
Let me tell you what I did. This is called Apothic Dark.
Okay.
And I did that for Nocturnal Animals.
Okay.
It's from that ancient wine region of Modesto, California. There's a romance in darkness. It draws our curiosity and beckons a desire to taste the unknown.
Oh, and I have tasted the unknown, and it's very heavy, I would say. How would you describe this wine?
Well, Apothic Dark would describe it as dark fruit flavors of blueberry and blackberry, with opulent notes of coffee and dark chocolate.
Wow. Okay, well, I'm sort of tasting a little bit of each of those, but not too bad, but definitely on the heavier side.
So we're going to lead off this week with the biggest movie of the week. It's a Harry Potter movie. It's Fantastic Beasts. I didn't see it, but I'm curious of how you felt about it, because unlike every other muggle on the face of the earth, you did not see Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Chamber of Secrets, Prisoner of Azkaban,
oh, yeah,
Goblet
I've seen
of Fire.
A few of them.
I thought like you're just not well versed in this universe.
I saw a few of them. I'm not well versed in the universe. That is true. I did not see all of them. I think I saw with my nephew, the Prince of Azerbaijan. Is that one of them?
Seriously, Anna?
And or was it the Half-Blood Prince and the other one? And I saw
Prince
the
Prince of Azerbaijan is awesome. I can't believe
and
you just said that.
And I saw the, what's it called?
I'm not going to correct you because I just love what you just said.
Thank
so
you.
Much.
And I saw like the last two. And so... And in this movie, what I've discovered is muggles in America are referred to as nomadges, not muggles. So it's sort of like no magic.
I like muggle better.
I know, but in America, it's nomadge.
Of course it is.
And so as someone who is not all that well-versed, obviously, in the Harry Potter universe, I still did enjoy it. I think it will absolutely work for people who want to return to that J.K. Rowling world, and it's a prequel of sorts. It's a spinoff that takes place in the 1920s in New York, and so it's like 70 years before Harry Potter.
Jeez.
Yeah, so it's kind of going back, but there's nods to Harry Potter, and I guess Harry Potter reads the books that are written by this Newt Scamander.
That's a strong name, Newt Scamander.
And so this first in what is supposed to be, I believe, 5 films about
five
Newt
films.
Scamander is a setup piece. And so it's really setting up the character of Newt, who is this magizoologist. He goes around the world and collects all these magical beasts and studies them, and they all hang out in his bottomless suitcase that's basically like Hermione's bottomless bag. And so just everything under the sun can fit into the suitcase. And he arrives in New York in 1920s from London. He's been traveling the world to collect these beasts, and he's there to pick up one more that he's sort of buying on the black market. And some of them escape from his suitcase, and you know, that can't be good. And so the movie is really about him trying to collect these beasts, and he ends up running afoul with this organization that's this secret world of wizards and witches in New York City. And they're pissed off that Newt Scamander's arrival and these beasts could expose regular, you know, nomadges, and aka muggles, to their world. And so yeah, it's Eddie Redmayne. Who doesn't love Eddie Redmayne?
Well, I was going to ask you. I saw it was Eddie Redmayne, and I wanted to ask: is it the theory of everything, Les Mis, Eddie Redmayne, or is it Jupiter Ascending, Eddie Redmayne?
Thank goodness it's not Jupiter Ascending, Eddie Redmayne. I'm trying to, like, actually, there's a term in this movie where you obviate, and it basically, it's erasing the memories of people, of muggles and nomadges who aren't supposed to know about these wizards and witches. And so I've decided to obviate Jupiter Ascending from the biography of Eddie Redmayne's roles, because he really is, he's very versatile. And in this one, he's very shaggy and scruffy and kind of endearing in his own way. And he enlists the help of these two witch sisters. They're like good witches. They're fun. They're the Goldstein sisters.
The Goldsteins.
And these quirky witch sisters are sort of working with him to try and set things right again. And there's also this nomad named Jacob Kowalski, played by Dan Fogler. And he's the all three of them basically provide the comic relief.
That's funny that they go to New York and they run into the Goldsteins and the Kowalskis.
Well, there's like the Jewish bakery, and so you know, it's actually quite it's kind of fun, but their comic relief is sort of the counterbalance to some parts of this movie that are very dark.
And Harry Potter has been notoriously dark in spots.
Yeah, and so this one's dark in spots, and so dark to the point where that's what makes it not so much a family-friendly film for young kids. It really, they need to be the older kids who really understand, you know, who aren't going to get scared by the notion of these dark forces that are inhabiting the bodies of kids and causing them to kill people. So that's what's happening when it's not being lighthearted and quirky. There's a dark undercurrent that also sets up what obviously will be the next sequence of films. And it's a new franchise based on this very successful franchise. And so I suspect that it will do quite well, both nationally and internationally. And we will see a lot more of Eddie Redmayne, a lot more of Fantastic Beasts, and we'll find them all over the place in the next 5-10 years.
Did it feel like a standard Harry Potter film? Did it feel like J.K. Rowling?
It did. She actually wrote the screenplay, and I think this is the first screenplay she's actually written for any of these movies.
She didn't write The Prince of Azerbaijan.
What is it called? You got to help me out here. I'm getting them all mixed up. But anyway, yeah, so I don't think she did. But for this one, she did write the screenplay, and I think she's got a lot of creative control. But the opening, the music that plays, and the vibe is very Harry Potter. And so, yes, it's familiar from the get-go. You know you are back in Harry Potter world, and you're looking, people who know it well will actually spot a lot of things that are precursors to, you know, to what happened decades later. There's a reference to Dumbledore. And there's references to some bad guys that are probably very young right now that turn into much older bad guys in the Harry Potter world.
Final question. Mm-hmm. Is there any Quidditch?
There is no Quidditch.
Aw, I like no. Quidditch.
Well, but you know, also you got to remember they're not actually anywhere near Hogwarts. This is all in New York.
You can
it's
play
like
Quidditch
Jazz Age New York.
Wherever. You just need a broom and like a ball.
Yeah, but that's why this isn't a kid's movie. So it's not the kind of movie that has a bunch of, you know, you don't have your Hermione and Harry relationship and Ron. And so.
Good. Nobody likes Ron.
I liked Ron. And so Ron was cute. But yeah, so it's different in that way. And it's. I think it works for people who know that world very well best, and it works fine for people who are just kind of getting their first real taste. But it is it's skewed, I would say, at this point, a little more adult.
Well, our next film is definitely about a muggle. She has real-world muggle problems that magic wouldn't even solve, and it's called The Edge of 17, and it's from a first-time director called Kelly Freeman Craig. And she was discovered by a very famous producer who discovers first-time filmmakers. I'm talking about James L. Brooks, the man who won 3 Oscars for Terms of Endearment, executive produced all 162 episodes of Mary Tyler Moore, and you see his name every Sunday on the opening credits of The Simpsons. Okay. He has executive produced 601 episodes and counting of The Simpsons, and he discovered this script called The Edge of 17 by Kelly Freeman Craig, and he says, you know what, I've done this before. Back in 96, I discovered Wes Anderson, so I'm going to do it again. And he did I think this is a good discovery. Nadine is a character who is real. She's high schooler with high school problems that she over-dramatizes, but she's complicated, she's complex, and I believe this girl could exist in the real world, not like most of the other high schoolers you see on film with their fake prom problems are, I'm not good looking, so all I have to do is take off my glasses and let my hair down. No, Nadine's got problems.
Yes, she does.
Her father died a couple years ago, and he's the only person on earth who understood her. She's different. She's different from her brother, who's the golden boy. He's the alpha male athlete, the academic leader, the peer leader, and she's Nadine. Nadine ain't got nothing special going on. Actually, she only has one friend. And she's played by Haley Lou Richardson. Her name's Krista. And the downfall, a little bit, if I have to find a problem with The Edge of 17, is that the script is so obvious. The dad was so nice, he was going to die. Krista, her only friend, obviously is going to take one look at the brother and is going to sleep with the brother. Now Nadine feels something has been stolen. Now she has nothing. She's alone in the world. And here, right there, is where The Edge of 17 takes off and wins and becomes a really good coming-of-age adolescent dramedy.
Yeah, no, it is. It was very surprising. I guess I didn't realize when I went into it that James Brooks was involved. And so I think his hand is definitely seen in this and that it's well-paced. The dialogue is really sharp. And the casting is very good. It's just, it's a 16 Candles. It's a John Hughes teenage flick for the new generation of high schoolers. And it's their Breakfast Club kind of thing. You know, you got this girl who's just angst-ridden and she's got extremely low self-esteem and she's so relatable. It's like everybody who's ever been a teenager or knows a teenager is going to recognize elements of these characters. And while it's not... you know, I'm not sure that it's going to reach many more people beyond the high school audience. I do think those are the folks that should definitely seek it out, and they'll enjoy it. And I know you hadn't mentioned when you reviewed it, the boyfriend. There's two guys that are sort of on opposite ends of her affections. She, of course, has to go. She makes really bad choices. And she knows she makes really bad choices. And
like any high schooler does.
Exactly. And so one of her bad choices is she sort of goes after this juvie kid who's...
I love her reasoning. He got so hot in juvie.
Yeah, he got hot in juvie. And so she wants to just sort of hook up with him because he's a bad boy and she's just trying to change her image.
He's misunderstood like
her.
Yeah,
like her. They're, you know, but... And so at least that's what she thinks. And in the meantime, you've got this sweet kid who's very chivalrous, who sits next to her in class and is very smitten with her despite all of her quirks. And he's Edwin, and he's trying to sort of woo her. And, you know, for a while, she just kind of overlooks this guy who would be really good, the good kid. And so there's that whole dynamic that plays into this movie. And then the other person that's really got a small role but plays it to the max is Woody Harrelson. And he's not your typical, you expect him to be always one of these history teachers who the troubled kid goes to and says, you know, I'm going to commit suicide. And he's like, okay, well, you know, good luck with that. You told me that every day for the past 2 months. And at first you think that he's really being very irresponsible, but then you realize that he's actually quite a responsible character. And I liked his role in this. He plays like this sounding board for her and is sarcastic and cynical, but at the same time turns out to be, I would say, a mentor to her. And so his role, I mean, for a Woody Harrelson role, it's very small, but I think he does well with it.
You mentioned 16 Candles, and I picked up the Perks of Being a Wallflower vibe here. In that one, there was a student-teacher dynamic, and there it was Paul Rudd who gave the kid some books to read. Here, Woody Harrelson is the only person on Earth who can stand up to Nadine. He doesn't take any of her crap. He sees right through her, and that makes her try harder to get any sort of reaction out of him, and he recognizes, I'm not going to react. In fact, he probably sees his younger self in there. And I identified a lot. I think everyone will identify with some shade of Nadine.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you were the jock in high school, there's a piece of you in Nadine. This has a 90210 problem. I didn't like the casting around Hailee Steinfeld. I loved Hailee Steinfeld. She was good. She's only 18. She fits the role, and she acts her butt off. She is good. And she's already got an Oscar nom under her belt. She was the girl in True Grit.
Mm-hmm.
But Darian, played by Blake Jenner, we saw him in Everybody Wants Some this year. Way too old. Way too old. These are not high school kids.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Everybody around Nadine, when you read their actual ages, even the kid Edwin is 30. And he doesn't look it. I mean, he looks maybe 20s. But yeah, no, you're right. I'm not sure. They are skewed kind of old, but I think the dialogue saves it. And Hailee Steinfeld, you know, when you first saw her in True Grit and she got this Oscar nomination, she was like 15, 16 years old.
She was young.
She
was younger than that.
She was really good. And I remember just being like, you know, let's see what she grows into. And she's still now one to watch because she's showing that she is really growing into a good adult actress. And she does. She carries this movie. She has the bulk of the dialogue. There's even a joke within there where she says at one point, you know, I think, do I talk too much? And everybody's like, yeah. She does. She talks a lot in this movie, and she pulls it off, and she's really just, you just root for her. You can't help but root for her, even though she's not necessarily the most likable person.
She reminded me of Enid from Ghost World 2001, played by Thora Birch. That was my favorite movie that year. I love that movie. And this is not as good as Ghost World. It's also not as good as Perks of Being a Wallflower. But for a high school film, man, I wish, they won't, but I wish high school students would go see this. It's about real people, and it's got a lead actress who just carries this vehicle. And I'm going to remember her come award time, I think. Not in the top tier, but she's going to be on there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. I would say she is she's one to watch for sure, in not only in this movie but down the line. And I hope you're right that high school kids should really go see this. And this is who it's geared towards.
Well, our next film stars a guy who has had awesome success with Whiplash and has been miserably used in atrocious teenage films, the Divergent series.
Oh, he's
as
okay.
Pretty much the worst character ever.
No.
So does Miles Teller, Hannah, break out of the teenage garbage in the boxing movie Bleed for This?
He goes somewhere between Whiplash and Divergent. I you know, it's not as powerful a movie as Whiplash was, but he certainly much stronger in this movie than in the Divergent series, although I think personally he was fine for that Divergent series. But in this one, you know, he makes this movie better than it otherwise would be because he is the type of actor who definitely seems to be very committed to his roles. And in this case, he's playing a real-life boxer named Vinny Pazienza, who had this horrific car accident while he was an up-and-coming boxer, and he broke his neck. And so he was determined not only to walk again, which the doctors were not so sure he'd ever do, but to box again. And so he chose, rather than get some surgery, he chose to have this halo that was basically screwed into his head that he had to wear for 6 months to keep his head and neck stabilized. And it's about his comeback. And he comes back to fight Roberto Duran. And I mean, it's not a spoiler. It's like you read anything about Vin Paz and you learn about his comeback story. And it's considered one of the most... you know, one of the greatest comeback stories in sports history, because he just really battled back from what many consider to be a career-ending injury. And there are elements. It's like every other boxing movie. It really is. It falls somewhere. It's like better than Southpaw, but not as good as Creed.
I was going to bring that up. Last year, we saw two boxing movies. Southpaw was not as good as Creed. Everyone loved Creed.
Yeah.
And you're saying Bleed for This is somewhere right in the middle. So it's better than Southpaw. Because Southpaw wasn't bad.
Exactly. And Southpaw wasn't bad. And this one's not bad. It's just you feel like you've seen elements of every aspect of this movie in something else, whether it's the fighter. There's a lot of stuff around his Catholic family sort of rallying around him. And I felt like I was watching that scene where with the mother and the whole family sitting watching The Fighter box in that movie, which was an amazing Oscar contender a few years ago. And so this reminded me a lot of The Fighter. It reminded me a lot of Rocky. It reminded me a little bit of every boxing movie
you could ever see. And it's reminding me of Million Dollar Baby.
Yeah.
Where, you know what? Right. She broke her neck too.
That's right.
And a halo didn't fix that.
But was that based on a true story? And so when you know that this is a real guy and that gives it extra, you know, when these movies are biopics and you know that somebody really just worked their tail off to overcome the odds. And Miles Teller owns this role. Like, you could just tell that he was committed. And he was very committed in Whiplash. And so I think when he finds these roles that he can totally immerse himself in, he does very well in them. So he's better than the movie. But at this end, you've got, for some reason, why are all trainers in these sports movies, they're always alcoholics? And in this case, you've got Aaron Eckhart playing this sort of, he puts on a few pounds for this movie. He was almost unrecognizable.
We just saw him in London Has Fallen.
Yeah.
He was very physically fit.
And he looks completely different. This is not the London Has Fallen Aaron Eckhart. This is a heavier, more receding hairline kind of Aaron Eckhart sort of playing this, you know, but he believes in Vinny and helps him with his comeback when nobody else thinks he should be doing that. But of course, he's got a drinking problem. And I don't know. It just seems like all these sports movies have remember what was the one with Hugh Jackman? Is that Eddie the Eagle? It's like they all seem to have drinking problems.
He was a very put together alcoholic, by the way.
Yeah.
Hugh Jackman was.
Exactly. And this guy is kind of a fairly put together alcoholic as well. They're all functional in their own way. But if you like a sports, just a good, solid sports comeback movie based on a true story that's interesting, and maybe even if you remember the fights, I think they were mostly through the 80s, then it's definitely, it might be worth seeing. I mean, I would put it on the list for maybe a rental or streaming at some point.
Yeah, I saw you right before you went to see this, because we had left another movie and you were tired.
Yes.
And you were wondering whether you should go. Any regrets?
No, because it's one of those movies that I'm just glad to have seen, so that if somebody asks about it, I can say that I saw it. I generally like sports dramas. I really do. And that's why I ultimately went to it. And I like based on true story, you know, biopic types movies. So it was a little tough because of the movie we came from just prior, but I'm glad I went.
That's exactly the transition I was going to use. You were tired and jaded because we had just walked out of Nocturnal Animals, a film I believe I enjoyed immensely more than you did. It was adapted and directed by Tom Ford, and we only know him from one other movie, 2009's A Single Man, that was starred Colin Firth as mm-hmm. a closeted
I love Colin Firth.
Gay man in the 50s. And so he's back now adapting. It was a 1993 novel by a man named Austin Wright. It's called Tony and Susan. And Nocturnal Animals is, I'm not going to lie, it's complicated. There's Present with Amy Adams in sitting alone in her very large Los Angeles mansion reading a book. There's The Past, where she was married to Jake Gyllenhaal, the guy who wrote the book in the present. But in the past, they're grad students, and she leaves him. And basically, she doesn't say it, but she calls him weak. He's a struggling writer, and she likes money a little bit too much. In the present, she's married to Armie Hammer, a philanderer. They have servants in their house. That is how stinking rich they are. She's an art gallery owner, and it's the kind of art that I wouldn't know it was art if I walked by it in a dumpster, but it's the kind of art that people pay $1 million for because it's, I guess you just call it modern art. It's got an opening
installation,
montage.
Installation art, yeah. Performance art involved.
The opening montage to this movie is one of the most original I've ever seen.
Yeah.
You don't, and then until the big reveal of what it is, you're like, how can this tie in? What is this going to be? It's shocking.
It's like a naked circus sideshow. That's what I was thinking.
There's just a lot of flesh, and it's not appetizing flesh.
No.
And then there's the novel. As Amy Adams reads, the novel comes to life, and it's also Jake Gyllenhaal as he's driving his family, his wife and daughter, through the night in West Texas. They are run off the road by redneck ruffians who kidnap the wife and daughter, rape and murder them. Not a spoiler, happens quick, but it doesn't feel quick, because that's just a brutal scene. And here's the complicated part. Here's the challenging part. Ladies, it feels weird, but it's a metaphor. Read into it.
That's right.
He's telling present-day Susan, this is what I feel about you. You raped and murdered me in our future and our past, and that's what I think is going on. And also in the past, or pardon me, in the novel, the detective who helps Tony, Jake Gyllenhaal's Tony, track down the bad guys is played by Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon launched himself into the Best Supporting Actor award season with this role. It's a stock role. I've seen this detective 1,000 times before, but Michael Shannon has a way of sitting there and staring at Jake Gyllenhaal. I've never seen someone stare that way in my life. It's phenomenal, Hannah.
I love Michael Shannon. I mean, he's just good in everything. I loved him in 99 Homes last year. He was even in one of those, was it Midnight Special that he was in?
You saw that.
So he's just good in everything. And he definitely is awards contender worthy and not in this one. It's not that I didn't like it. I mean, I just even think people listening to how you were trying to describe it are probably still trying to wrap their heads around how this all plays together.
But it does. You can figure it out.
You can figure it out, but you have to sort of be ready to figure it out, and you have to be okay with a movie that is very Hitchcockian. It's twisted. It's brutal to watch in parts. It just gets dark. And so it's... it was hard to go from that movie to Bleed for this, but it did stick with me. So I give it that. I give it credit for being the type of movie that the more you thought about it, I think everyone had their own theories coming out of that movie as to exactly what the end scenes meant and what you were supposed to draw from the parallels of the past and the present. The art stuff is just weird. I'm sorry. It's like the kind of thing where if you're one of these multimillionaires who goes and bids on art that somebody else goes, I can't believe you even paid $1 for that. That's the kind of art we're talking about. That it's just weird stuff.
And you have to play along. Sometimes they will cut to a shot of Jake Gyllenhaal. And it'll take you a second or two. It's like, wait, is this novel Jake Gyllenhaal or is this past Jake Gyllenhaal?
Yeah.
And you don't know until they widen out. I love the cinematography. It was shot by Seamus McGarvey, and we just talked about him a couple weeks ago because he did The Accountant. In the present scenes, which is very sterile, her house is very clean, and there's no clutter. It is it's crystal clear, and you can tell it's shot digital. In the novel, which is saturated in yellow, he shot on film. I think it was 35mm film. And the yellows compared to the present-day blues was a great contrast, and I really liked that, how they just separated the different parts of the movie. I thought that was so effective. I'm not aching to see this again. I usually don't like to watch movies again once I've seen them, but this one especially, there's not... The novel stuff is so rough. It's so violent. I don't cover my eyes ever, but I was at 45 degrees a little bit.
I think I was at 45 degrees. Maybe it was 90. Maybe it was 180.
Do you remember Mulholland Drive? This reminds me of Mulholland Drive, a film that people still argue about today about what it all means.
Yeah, and there are a few of those. And like Brazil was another one I remember being like, what the heck did that?
But this is going to be around award. People are talking about this.
And not just it. That's why I went to see it, is that it's not a genre. It's a revenge. It's like a psychological thriller revenge movie. And it has some traumatic stuff in it. And so for me, that's just not generally the kind of movie that I'm going to go see for escapist fare, because it is very it's draining almost to go and see some of these movies. And I would not watch it again, but I can understand why some folks really would be very into it and enjoy the dissection process. And I, you know, really, it sticks with you without a doubt.
I don't know if you want to bring it up at this point, but as we were walking out of the theater, we got into it. Before we even talked about what happened, the plot, the story, the acting, whatever, you started talking about, who would I recommend this to? Would I send Eileen to this? Would I send Stacy to this? Would I send Jennifer to this? My nephew, my niece, my mom? And I was like, wait. Think about the film. Talk about the film. Did it work? Was it effective? Was it awful? Why was it good? Why was it bad? And I think, and so I got on you for like, this is why you don't like certain movies, because you're too busy thinking about the third party.
And in response to that, my argument to you is that you might think this movie is incredible for whatever reason and deep and thought-provoking, but nobody in their right minds would want to see it. Or there's too many other things out there that I would send people to first. And so I am, you know, I write under the pseudonym mainstream chick for a reason, is that I think it is, I take it as my responsibility to people who want to know whether a particular movie will appeal to a mainstream audience. And so I look at these movies I do look at them and go, who would I recommend this to? And if there isn't a slice of the audience that I can point to, that I can say, oh, I know this person would absolutely like this movie, or people who like X movie will certainly like this one. And I think that those two things, I think there's a happy medium to be found. And I think that's what we're finding right now a little bit, is that I did think about it after the fact, but I'm still not sure who I would send this to.
And the reason we really got into it is because that is such a narrow lens to view a movie through. if it falls outside of your mainstream comfort zone, which most independent and heavy drama films do, you immediately identify it, catalog it, and discount it as outside your mainstream
category. I don't discount category. It. I don't discount it at all. I do look at it as being outside the mainstream category and knowing that it is not something that is going to gain any traction with the mainstream audience. And so when somebody's looking at if I'm going to spend $15 or, you know, $50 to take a few people to go see a movie, I want folks to know what movie is going to potentially appeal to the most, to the broadest audience.
That sounds like to the lowest common denominator.
No, not always, because sometimes if it's a group of girls going for a night out to a movie, there's a certain kind of movie they all might want to see to just have some fun. If it's a date movie for two people who are very high thinkers and cerebral and like a thriller and a psychological thriller, I would recommend this one to them.
I think they can figure it out for themselves while we are focusing on content.
I think it's a double-edged sword. I think there's content, but I also think there is a responsibility to not send people to a movie that they're going to hate because it's expensive and there's a lot of stuff out there. And so you want people to find the movies that are going to make them most satisfied and happy with their movie-going experience.
Meaning make sure we don't send them to anything that would challenge them.
No, it's, I disagree respectfully, well, Charlie.
All right, moving on, because we could argue about this all day.
Yes, we could.
Coincidentally, or for use your adverb, that is not the Nocturnal Animals is not the only movie we saw this week about rape or heavily involving rape. This next French film called Elle is all about rape, and it's by an infamous, notorious director. His name is Paul Verhoeven. He is Dutch, and he is very well known in the United States for Basic Instinct, RoboCop, Total Recall, Showgirls. He's been in the news. Not only is he in the news this week because he is releasing a film, he's in the news because he's saying, what happened to the erotic thriller? Where did it go? Everything chased the PG-13 rating for probably financial reasons, but I agree with him. There is a place in cinema for Basic Instinct, maybe not Showgirls, but and maybe not L, because L kicks off immediately with, you don't see it, you hear a brutal sexual assault, and then you see it through the eyes of the cat. A man in a black mask and wearing all black busts into the Paris house of Isabelle Huppert. She's the lead actress. I don't remember her name right now. And he brutally rapes her. And what happens? Does she call the cops? Does she cower? Does she cry? Does she run away? No. She gets up and she walks it off. She's like, I just got raped and I'm going to walk it off. And over dinner, over appetizers, I'm going to tell maybe some people, oh, by the way, earlier today I was raped. You know, how are you?
That's right. Yeah, this is a psychological thriller that was actually even more disturbing than Nocturnal Animals. So I think my whole mindset shifted slightly about Nocturnal Animals after then seeing this French film, Elle, and Isabelle Huppert is Michelle LeBlanc.
Michelle LeBlanc, Michelle. That's right. Thank you.
And so Michelle is, she's like the CEO of some erotic video game company. Even those video games were on par with like the bizarre art in Nocturnal Animals. And yeah, and it's all about, it's another sort of revenge type movie, I guess.
Some people say it's cat and mouse, and I think that's a mischaracterization. She spends most of the movie afraid.
Yeah, but she's like attempting to track down her attacker on her own, and there's reasons for that. She didn't want to go to the police, and you don't understand why at first, but as the narrative unfolds, she's got a history that explains a little bit about why she doesn't really trust the justice system and doesn't want to go to the cops. And so there are a lot of layers. For me, the most amazing thing is that this movie is in French with English subtitles. And you know her performance has got to be pretty darn amazing because I really did not think about the fact that I was reading subtitles.
We just talked about Hailee Steinfeld and how she'd probably make my list somewhere. Isabelle Huppert is getting ranked higher than Hailee on that. I really liked her. Talk about carrying a movie. And she is internationally known as being one of the world's greatest actresses. She's won the Best Actress Prize twice at Cannes, which is a phenomenal feat to do only once. But we're talking about, it's a French film. It's actually not supposed to be. Verhoeven was going to, he wanted this to be an American film. He was going to recreate Basic Instinct for American audiences. And then Nicole Kidman turned it down. Diane Lane turned it down. Julianne Moore turned it down. Kate Blanchett turned it down. Kate Winslet turned it down. We can see why.
But there's actually see them, and I can see several of them.
They're all
them.
The same. This is in their wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But they read the script and like, American audiences won't go anywhere near rape and walk it off story. Yeah. They just won't touch it. And they're right. And then Verhoeven are like, yeah, why, you know what? Why don't I make this in French? It's based off a French novel. And Parisians, film-loving Parisians, would be all over this movie. And I think they will. I think they will be.
It's a very disturbing film, without a doubt. If I had to pick one word, it would just be disturbing. And I made it through. I'm
surprised you did, because it's long.
It's long. It was long. And when you consider the fact that you're reading, but you're drawn in by her performance and just her glances and her asides, and you realize the levels of manipulation that are going on is quite amazing. And so, not the kind of movie I would ever in a million years typically go and see. Not the kind of movie I would recommend to many people, unless they are people who enjoy foreign films and have that sensibility like you, where they're okay with seeing a French movie every week.
Well, I find it funny that of all the French movies we talk about on here, Elle's the one you choose to see.
It's timing. It's all about, you know, whether we have a link, whether I have time to see it, and whether or not I feel like just being able to surprise you with the fact that I did actually watch it.
Well, for one, I'm very happy to welcome Paul Verhoeven back. I agree with him. We do need adult-driven, mature, erotic thrillers. There's a place for them. I'm sad they've mostly disappeared. They don't need to be all about rape. Basic Instinct wasn't. It was about murder while having sex. And you know what? We need murder while having sex movies. And so I'm glad he's back, and he helped the genre out immensely.
He might have helped the genre out, but I still don't see this kind of movie ever floating with American audiences.
No, American audiences aren't going to see this. Like, no. Two people at the Art House are going to see this. John. Finally, a film.
One person will see this next one. If two people see Elle, one person John. Will see The Love Witch. Go for it, Charlie.
A film stranger than Elle, The Love Witch, written and directed by a woman named Anna Biller. It's a tribute. It's a satire. It's an homage to 1960s Technicolor thrillers, classic Hollywood studio, like, color photography. Think Hitchcock. Think, what did Vertigo look like? What do the birds look like? I'm not comparing The Love Witch to Vertigo. But look
Please
at
don't.
Them. If you look at them, okay, there's the similarity. The best thing going for The Love Witch is the lead actress, Samantha Robinson. I couldn't take my eyes off her. She was so good. And she plays like a bad actress. Like, yeah. I don't know, like, I guess they used to act this way in the 60s. And you know what? They did. It reminded me of a late Katharine Hepburn. And she's just phenomenal. She plays a witch. She's in a coven. There's a Renaissance fair in there. She makes love potions to make men fall in love with her.
Disgusting love potions, I might add.
But they're a little too strong. And the men overly fall in love with her, where they start crying, and that turns her off. And then she ends up...
Come on, it's not a spoiler. They all die.
Yeah, but some, like, are direct deaths because of her, and some are indirect deaths. And it's for the look. Anyone who goes to this has to know it's not a break. You don't go to see The Love Witch for the story. You go, the one person who's going to go, because you remember 1960s Technicolor thrillers is why you go.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like one of those 60s Technicolor thrillers, but also just even it. Some of it plays like the really cheesy 60s sitcoms and TV and dramas. It's the delivery is so affected and satirical, I guess it's supposed to be in its own sort of way. You've got these cops who look like they're straight out of Dragnet, and you have the lead actress who looks like 99 and Get Smart with her get-ups.
She
reminded
like
me. She looked a lot like 99 with the long dark hair
and
the boots.
Gorgeous on that 35mm film. I just fell in love with looking at it.
Well, and I've seen more naked bodies in the six movies that we saw this week. And this one's like orgy type of nudity. And it reminded me...
But they're not really having sex.
She's
not
is
a
with
hard
that.
R.
It is when she's... Oh, no. When she's with that first guy with the professor that...
Did they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't remember that.
Yeah. And in fact, that professor, and you talk about like level of actors and whether you know their names. I saw that guy and I go, oh, he's the guy. He was killed off of General Hospital twice in the past 2 years.
No kidding.
The guy who played the professor.
Well, she lives
professor.
In this Victorian Gothic house, and they go to this Victorian tea room. It's a film of the woman, put woman in quotes. It's a female empowerment film. She's a strong woman, and the men are so weak. It's telling, you know, the men are just awful, except maybe the detective who's
But
not
she's
that
a
weak.
Psychopath. She's a witch psycho.
No, it's not telling you to, like, model your life
with
after
major
her.
Daddy issues.
She is a narcissist. She's a sociopath, but it's, It's fun and it's a boring drag.
It's I gave up. So I watched the first hour. And this, again, what's with these movies that you have these great movies that somehow manage to contain themselves to, you know, like a solid minute 50 or hour 50 or 2 hours tops. And then you've got some of these wacky indies that are just way too long for what they are. And this one, when I saw that I was an hour into it and there was still like another hour left and I could see where it was going, it's like, okay, next guy.
Not gonna lie, boom. I felt that too, and I have a longer attention span.
Yeah.
Than you do.
And so I did skip ahead then to the last 10 minutes.
Shame.
Because I needed to know how it ended.
Shame.
And it, I still.
You missed the Renaissance fair.
All I know is that I think she found her Prince Charming in the end and killed him. And I
spoilers.
Don't think that's a spoiler.
Oh my god, it's a huge spoiler.
I'm sorry for the one person.
I can't believe you did that.
That might go see it, but it's debatable. So
my question, I said before we pressed record on this podcast, I said I have a question for you. Yes. That I'm going to set you up with for The Love Witch. Is The Love Witch an example of style over substance?
I don't know, because it reminds, yes, because it reminds me of the type of movies that like college friends would go out and make. It's, you know, written, directed, edited by the same person. And you just know that it's one of these passion projects that...
She made the costumes, too. The director made the costumes.
It's like, it's her movie entirely, but the fact that this all came out of her head is frightening. So, yes, it's about the style, and, you know, I called it, like, a Twisted Bewitched.
I like it.
Meets the Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Big thumbs up for you come up with Twisted Bewitched.
Twisted Bewitched meets Rocky Horror Picture Show, and the whole witch angle you have to realize, too, it's, like, it's accepted that there are witches in this society.
Until they, like, rise up... Flyover State style.
Yeah.
And like, or like Burn the Witch.
But right, until there's that. But at the same time, there's like, there's a guy who teaches classes at like the witch college or something. And he talks about, you know, his classes include like herbs and spices and magic sex potions. It was very bizarre.
But she got herself a really good cinematographer, M. David Mullen. He did Twin Falls, Idaho, the 2004 film North Fork, which is just, the story was awful, but it was... So, I remember it was so good looking. And Megan Fox's 2009's Jennifer's Body.
Okay.
If you remember that.
No, I don't.
You don't remember Jennifer's Body?
I don't remember Jennifer's Body. But
that's like the second Diablo Cody film after Juno.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, stylistically, and there were moments where I laughed out loud. Like, it was so absurd that I chuckled.
Because Samantha Robinson is awesome.
Yeah, her delivery, it's played, it's like she plays straight. She plays it straight.
No one's going to see this movie.
And no one's going to see this movie. I mean, really, I, you know, you talk about who you'd recommend it to.
John.
Other than John. there's nobody other than people who love like
Turner Classic Movies.
A B-movie cult classic.
Turner Classic
kind of
Movies.
Thing.
If you watch Turner Class Movies 2 to 3 times a week, this is for you.
At least, I don't even know if they'd really get it. But Love Witch made Elle and Nocturnal Animals seem almost mainstream.
Well, Nocturnal Animals is almost mainstream.
Yeah, Nocturnal Animals is closer to mainstream.
Amy Adams in it. It's not that crazy.
But, but at least the difference is I did make it through all those other movies. The Love Witch, as you said, it dragged.
Oh, yeah.
And so that, I think, is its death blow, is that whereas you kind of could almost tell people there's that nostalgia factor of 60s style to go watch this for.
She looks it,
but it's ultimately it gets really, really boring.
Oh, yeah.
And so therefore I don't think anyone in their right minds is necessarily going to go out and find this.
Probably not. All right, very quickly, because this is a long podcast now to recap. I can't believe I don't even remember it now. Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
Yeah, and it's good. It's definitely for the Potter fans. Go for it.
Edge of 17, if you're in high school, consider it homework.
Yeah, it's your Breakfast Club. Enjoy.
They don't know Breakfast Club.
They should.
Bleed
go
for
rent
this.
Breakfast Club and then watch The Edge of 17.
Bleed for this.
It's your standard boxy movie. If you like a comeback sports drama, then it's okay. It's not the best of the genre. It's not the worst.
Nocturnal Animals, best film of the week.
Really creepy. Creepy.
L, too much rape.
Yeah, way too much rape. I'm still getting over. I'm just kind of still stunned by a lot of what I saw in that movie. But if you like foreign films and don't mind subtitles and like really twisted stuff, sorry,
bleep,
then go check out Elle.
The Love Witch, I think that just is what just caused your mental faculties to escape you right there. Love Witch, I don't know. John, let me know.
Yeah. It ain't spellbinding, let's just say.
All right. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you for listening.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.